reinvigorated by waves of Hondurans and Venezuelans that, you know, that imagine themselves fleeing left-wing, you know, tyrants, Nicaraguans. And so it's it's contributed to the turning of Florida into this laboratory of Trumpism and headquarters of a kind of Mar-a-Lago as a kind of headquarters of a Pan-American Trumpism, pan-hemispheric Trumpism.
What shocked you most in researching this, 700-page epic work?
Oh, well, I guess what shocked me most, what I was so surprised with was how the good neighbor, we know the good neighbor policy as a phrase associated with Franklin Roosevelt as his treatment of Latin America, but it was also the phrase that they used as to get out the vote in his 1936 reelection. And it became the Good Neighbor Leagues was set up as a counter to the Liberty Leagues, explicitly anti-fascist. They were meant to embody a certain kind of cultural pluralism and acceptance of the diversity of the nation, and they were understood explicitly as an alternative to the white supremacist Liberty Leagues. And they basically delivered the vote to Roosevelt. He won 20 million votes. He won more votes than any other human being in history up until that point. And he did so running on a policy of social democracy.
Greg Grandin, our guest for the hour, history professor at Yale University, Pulitzer Prize winning author, his new book, America, America, A New History of the New World. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Democracy Now!
Hi, I'm Queen Ida, and you're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM on your radio. Your spot for Cajun and Zydeco music. Bon ton roulet.
Okay, let's go now, yeah.
Here we go again, it's the game we love.
Play game.
Tune in on the first and third Tuesday of the month at 11 a.m. for Winner's Bias, a new show exploring the culture around tabletop gaming. From game nights to conventions, Nate and James share what makes the hobby so vibrant through banter and interviews with local members of the hobby game scene. And if we can inspire a few listeners to join us around the table, all the better. More people to play with. Winner's Bias. You don't have to win to have fun, but it doesn't hurt. The first and third Tuesday of the month at 11 a.m.
Support for KBOO comes from its members and from Barbara Bernstein's film Chasing Chimeras, The Lure of Deceptive Climate Solutions, a film about the effects of industry-led climate solutions and how the fossil fuel industry has influenced regulatory agencies and laws. Chasing Chimeras premieres at Cinema 21 on April 27th at 4 p.m. More info at chasingchimeras.org.
Rushamadian. Armenian memory books present accounts of the genocide in the regions they cover, explore its legacies, and document the rebuilding of exilic communities. These books constitute a tremendous resource for scholars in the fields such as history, ethnography, geography, natural history, cartography, demography, genealogy, and art. Mapping the geographical distribution of villages and towns that have dedicated Rushamadians would dot the length and breadth of modern-day Turkey. The exilic communities where Armenian memory books were published span continents.
That's Khachig Muradyan, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Khachig Muradyan on Rushamadian, Armenian memory books. April 24th marks the 110th anniversary of the Armenian Genocide. I grew up in the 1950s in New York in the shadow of that tragedy. I was surrounded by survivors named Garabedian, Giragosyan, Hagopian, and others. who always spoke of Yergir, the country they were forced to abandon. My mother, Araxi, was from Dubne, a village near Diyarbakir, and my father, Bedros, was from Nibishi, a village near Palu, in what is now eastern Turkey. Their memories, and those of others from the old country, filled my ears, as did their tales of how they escaped death and got to America. I'd listen to their stories in Armenian, not understanding everything, but knowing for them, Yergir was a special place. It was home. Husha Madyan are memory books of a millennial-old civilization virtually lost, but not forgotten. Our guest today is Khachig Muradyan. He's the Armenian and Georgian area specialist at the Library of Congress and a lecturer in Middle Eastern, South Asian, and African studies at Columbia University. He also serves as co-principal investigator of the Project on Armenian Genocide Denial at the Global Institute for Advanced Studies at NYU. He's the author of The Resistance Network and the editor of the journal The Armenian Review. He spoke at the National Association for Armenian Studies and Research in Belmont, Massachusetts in mid-November 2024. The moderator is Mark Mamigonyan. And now, Khachig Muradyan.
Using a map of a village households before everyone was deported or killed during the 1915 Armenian Genocide, we navigated the streets of Havav in Kovancalar, modern-day Turkey, and stopped at a door. A few pairs of worn-out sandals were neatly lined up nearby. The memory map, hand-drawn in New York in 1966, identified the modest house as my friend's great-grandparents' home. A third-generation Armenian-American, and the first in the family to set foot in his ancestral village since the genocide, he froze in front of that humble abode and wept. Moments such as this, frequent as they have been during visits to historically Armenian-populated areas that are now within the borders of Turkey, remain etched in my memory. On these research trips and pilgrimages, we are often guided, as we were in Havav, by Husha Madyans, literally memory books, repositories of the history, geography, and ethnography of ancestral hearths lost to genocide and exile. The displaced do not build new homes. They reenact old ones. The expropriation and deportation of the Armenians from their ancestral homeland in Ottoman Turkey during the First World War, the accompanying massacres and deprivations that killed up to 1.5 million, and the subsequent systematic erasure of thousands of cultural heritage sites that left behind a devastated land and a decimated nation, reeling in exile. And as the displaced reassembled, shattered communities and lives in tatters, the longing for home seeped into their labor and often defined it. The literary genre of memory book was born out of the survivors' angst to inculcate in the next generation, who had never seen the old country, the same yearning for those inaccessible geographies tucked behind the borders of the Republic of Turkey. In the introduction to his memory book on Sis, modern-day Kozan in Turkey, Misa Kelesyan writes, "Another decade or two, with the disappearance of the elders who remember our birthplace, narrators of its beauty will no longer exist. And our children and grandchildren, headed in a direction away from homeland and memory, left to the mercy of the wings of fortune, surrendered to the all-consuming floods of foreign shores, would have to prepare for the permanent loss of traditions. Consumed by the aim of preempting this horrible disaster, we got to work and made an effort to instill among Armenians, and particularly among people of Sis, the love of their birthplace." End of quote. In her book, The Generation of Post-Memory, scholar Marianne Hirsch observes, "To grow up with overwhelming inherited memories, to be dominated by narratives that preceded one's birth, is to risk having one's own life displaced, even evacuated, by our ancestors." End of quote. Children of Armenian survivors found themselves in a similar predicament as they grew up in Beirut, Paris, and New York, entangled in stories of a bygone life in their ancestral homes and personal accounts of Medz-Yeghern, the great crime. Although decidedly an offspring of the 1915 genocide, the memory book draws inspiration from regional histories published in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, including works about places like Zeytun that captured the imagination of Armenian nation with their resilience and resistance against centralized Ottoman authority and oppression in the 19th century. The genre took shape in the post-genocide exilic life of the 1920s and 1930s, and within a few decades, the Armenian memory book, Husham Adyan, had already become a noticeable phenomenon in the diaspora, in the words of the author of one such book, On the Town of Tomarza, published in 1959. A few words about how this genre sort of picked up. Historian Arshak Alboyadjian's two-volume, 2,500-page opus, Batmutyun Hayots Gesaryo, History of the Armenians of Gesaria, Kayseri, was a genre-defining early Husham Adyan that for decades served as a source of envy, inspiration, and emulation. The book was published in 1937 in Cairo. In an effusive review that appeared the same year in the journal Sion, the then Armenian Patriarch of Jerusalem, himself a prolific and established author and researcher, lauded the work for, quote, "reviving the dead past and reassembling a scattered present," end quote. He called for publishing such histories of all Armenian populated towns and villages lost to the genocide. We need one of these for our own discussions, cascaded across the hundreds of Armenian compatriotic unions in the diaspora, created by and for Armenian exiles from specific villages, towns, and regions. One cannot overestimate the enormous engagement, interest, and sort of envy that some of these early works engendered as, you know, communities, compatriotic unions from different towns and villages wanted to have one of their own as well represented, one such book. The genre became an enterprise. Meanwhile, Alboyadjian himself wrote two more memory books, one on Malatya and another on Tokat, had to turn down a request for producing a few others. We hear about this in the introductions of several other volumes. He wrote the introduction for a few and is either credited as the inspiration for or is referenced in many others. Compiling these volumes often requires years of research and outreach. Authors and editors pored over medieval Armenian manuscripts, history books, newspapers, articles, and maps. They interviewed elders and solicited written accounts by mail and through ads in newspapers. The effort took a toll. And I'm quoting here from Antvanik Poladian, who edited a volume on Arabgir. He says, "Sometimes I had to read an entire volume to prepare a one-page biography." He adds, "Let me say, however, that it was easier to concern oneself with the dead than the living. For example, to receive the biography of a teacher living in Syria, I wrote three letters and received it after 4 years." End quote. Not all memory book authors and editors were prolific historians and journalists like Alboyadjian and Poladian. Many of them hadn't published much else and embarked on their journey and of writing a memory book, armed with little more than a passion for their native village or town. They often disclosed their shortcomings outright and hoped to make up for what the book lacked in structure, cohesion, and scholarly rigor with the mortar of raw authenticity that embraced its bricks. Others complained about their inability to access sources or visit the towns they were recreating. Mistakes are inevitable, the author of a memory book lamented, because the work was written, quote, 47 years after the exodus from Kilis, a town in modern-day Turkey bordering Syria, when much information and many valuable documents are forever lost, end of quote. A most moving acknowledgement of limitations adorns the introduction to the memory book on the village of Tsitor in the Garin, Erzurum region. The editor, Vartiter Kocholosyan Hovannisyan, she's one of the very few women who edited memorial books or wrote memorial books, expresses hope that the reader will approach the work with understanding, noting that despite their enthusiasm, most contributors hesitated to accept the invitation to write because, and I quote, for known reasons, they have received little or no education or are self-taught. But, she continues, their national consciousness overpowered their feelings of inadequacy. And, I'm quoting again, with modesty and shaking hands, they picked up the pen. What an inspiring and at the same time heart-wrenching phenomenon. An expression of an Armenian person's, especially an Armenian villager's, venerated virtue of offering their life, their soul, their possessions, and even from what they do not possess. And so she concludes in the introduction, like my father often says, these are her words, willy-nilly we joined the caravan with a limping donkey. The result? A magisterial 364-page memory book published in Beirut in 1972, complete with a mental map of the village, a list of its pre-genocide inhabitants, and another of the descendants of the survivors. The latter also details each person's professions and where in exile they settled. So limping or not, the published memory books are often success stories against massive odds. Wars and conflicts, most notably World War II, disagreements among compatriotic unions and commissioned authors, as you can imagine, and personal circumstances sometimes delayed or even capsized memory book projects. Some authors, like those of the memory books on Kilis and Bardizak, Bahçecik, respectively, became very ill or died prior to the project's completion. And the compatriotic union had to find another editor. In a number of cases, including the two-volume work on Sepastia, Sivas, a memory book on Hüseynik, Ulukent, now a neighborhood of Elazığ, and a third one on Tomarza, the principal authors or editors took pride in completing the project despite their advanced age. In the Sepastia case, the journey from conception to completion took 32 years. The author who finally ushered the book to the finish line wrote that he must have survived the genocide for this very purpose. It must have been his way of coping with survivor's guilt. Some 300 published titles, alongside many unpublished ones, and specialized periodicals dedicated to the Armenian populated regions, towns, or villages in the former Ottoman Empire were thus produced in the decades after the genocide, primarily in Armenian. Again, one cannot overstate how significant this drive was. What we have in published form is a fraction of what is out there. Some of these memory books that were not published were entirely dedicated to towns, and therefore there were biographies of these towns and villages. Others were memoirs of the survivor, as well as a memory book of the town and village. And drawers, shelves of families around the world are full of accounts such as this, from some that are just a few dozen pages to others that are hundreds of pages. They offer a window into the history, demography, culture, folklore, art, literature, photography, religion, politics, customs, genealogy, trades, crafts, and flora and fauna in the regions they cover. Similar to, but predating, Yizkor books published in the aftermath of the Holocaust, or histories of Palestinian villages destroyed during the Nakba, Armenian memory books present accounts of the genocide in the regions they cover, explore its legacies, and document the rebuilding of exilic communities. These books constitute a tremendous resource for scholars in the fields such as history, ethnography, geography, natural history, cartography, demography, genealogy, and art. Mapping the geographical distribution of villages and towns that have dedicated Hushamadians would dot the length and breadth of modern-day Turkey, from Smyrna, Izmir, to Giresun, from the coastal town of Giresun to the entire Pontus region on the Black Sea, to dozens of towns and villages near the Syrian border and on the Mediterranean. The exilic communities where Armenian memory books were published span continents. They include Los Angeles, Detroit, Boston, New York, Buenos Aires, Montevideo, Bucharest, Plovdiv, Vienna, Paris, Marseille, Lyon, you get the point. And a closer look reveals, however, that the United States, France, Lebanon, Syria, and Egypt, important 20th century publishing centers of the Armenian diaspora, produced the lion's share of memorial books. The United States and Lebanon have carried this distinction into the 21st century. Memory books and yearbooks dedicated to Kharpert and its surrounding archipelago of towns and villages would easily fill a shelf or two. Kharpert is identified as modern-day Elazığ. The village of Pazmashen alone, with an Armenian population of about 1,500, is memorialized in at least two books, both published in Massachusetts in 1930. Even tiny villages sometimes have entire volumes dedicated to them. Ohu, Bulgurjuk, a village in the region of Palu, comprises a mere 25 households before World War I, yet one of its villagers wrote a 181-page memory book about it. The city of Aintab, home to a thriving and diverse Armenian population of about 30,000 prior to the genocide, boasts half a dozen memory books, including a two-volume, 2,000-page Batmutyun Antebi Hayots by Kevork Sarafian, History of Aintab Armenians, a renowned educator, and the 327-page English language version. Now, the memory book had to safeguard what was salvaged and recreate what was lost with an authenticity that authors hoped would allow returnees to one day pick up where their ancestors had left off. Manuk Cizmecian, the author of a memory book on Kharpert, entreats his readers not to forget the town which awaits, and I quote, its children scattered around the world to return, rebuild, and make it flourish for the benefit of civilization, end of quote. All senses needed to be engaged. Authors went to great lengths to describe the vernacular, as well as the sights, the sounds, and scents of the region. The overwhelming majority of memory books include glossaries and chapters dedicated to the local dialects, expressions, and sayings. Toros Madakhjan's Hushamadyan Tomarzai, Memory Book of Tomarza, for example, features a 50-page dictionary. Kalus Trumenyan's Memory Book on Yerzanga, Erzincan, for instance, dedicates a section to the region's climate, even describing the features of the air people breathed, in hopes that the reader, too, could vicariously take in the air of the lost homeland. In the foreword to his father's memory book on the village of Hüsenik, Dr. Hagop Martin Duranian writes, "This book has allowed me to turn back the clock and walk the streets of Hüsenik vicariously, to smell its abundant and fragrant flowers, to drink from the cool and refreshing waters of Setchasem spring, to hear the melodious choir of St. Varvar Church, to be moved by Pastor Andreasyan's intelligent sermons, and to be terrified beyond description by the events of June 1915. Authors often employ tools other than the written word. Many thousands of photographs, detailed sketches and drawings, sheet music of folk songs, genealogy charts, and various types of maps are the collective legacy of these volumes. Poladian's work on Arapgir features some 50 pages of sheet music. Manuk Zeron's memory book on the village of Parchanj in the Kharpert region features dozens of sketches depicting village life, games, tools, utensils, and other objects, in addition to a plethora of maps, floor plans, extensive genealogy charts, and photographs. Published in Armenian Boston in 1938 and in English in Fresno in 1984, the book is a veritable work of art, an artifact. Now, some authors were brutally honest about the good, the bad, and the downright ugly in the old country. In his memory book on Bardizag, Bahçecik, Grigor Mkhalyan writes about betrayal, intrigue, corruption, and conflict among members of the clergy in the town, and delves into what he refers to as seedy traditions and unhygienic practices. Here's a striking example of the latter. The bathrooms were badly and inconveniently constructed. Behind or on the flank of the house, somewhere away from sight, there were narrow and long passageways, wooden floored, at the deep end of which was a circular or triangular opening on the floor that looked at the bottom, fully exposed, no gutter. All around the village, the narrow alleyways, human waste piled up over days, sometimes months, and smelled. Passersby held their nose from the stench, and the air inside the houses didn't remain clean either. People waited for torrential rain to carry away the waste. A bag over their heads, men would, under the torrential rain, often employ hose to assist the streams of water to complete the cleaning. End of quote. But most memory books err on the side of romanticizing, hyperbole, and window dressing. They often portray an immaculate, idyllic world that was torn away from its native people. Joan Didion writes, "A place belongs forever to whoever claims it hardest, remembers it most obsessively, wrenches it from itself, shapes it, renders it, loves it so radically that he remakes it in his own image." End of quote. In many Armenian memory books, one can read between the lines the author telling the genocide perpetrators, "You take away our homeland? Watch us remake it into the best possible version of itself and of ourselves." In the introduction to his monumental work on Gesaria, Alboyadjian likens the memory book to the ornate urn carrying the remains of one's ancestors, arguing that every Armenian from the region, whether or not they can read the language, will want to have a book in their home. In the Sis Kozan volume, the reader is invited to, quote, "accept the book as a necessary ornament on their bedside," end quote. And while today many Armenians treat memory books as precious artifacts connecting families to a lost homeland, much like the home key does for a generation of Palestinians who lost their ancestral homes during the Nakba, those who find it difficult to secure copies of out-of-print memorial books or find the language inaccessible have a wealth of options. In recent years, the Armenian Catholicosate in Cilicia and Lebanon has reprinted many memory books, each with a comprehensive index that earlier editions lacked. The Library of Congress and other institutions, like Nasser, hold extensive collections of published Shushamadians and several unpublished ones. Thanks to the efforts of Shushan Yenikomshian Tiger, a proud Aintab Armenian, the Nasser Mardiganian Library now boasts a dedicated room for memory books. One can also download digital copies of some of these works free of charge from the National Library of Armenia's website. An increasing number of memory books are now available in English, including Mkhalyan's Bardizak and its inhabitants referenced earlier. Lost Paradise, Memories of a Land and Its People, and Tadem, My Father's Village, extinguished during the 1915 Armenian Genocide. Moreover, the Hushamadyan project to reconstruct Ottoman Armenian life richly draws from memory books to offer resources on Armenian populated regions of the Ottoman Empire in Armenian, English, and Turkish. Hushamadyan has been, for the past several years now, an absolute beacon for those looking for information about their culture and heritage in the ancestral towns and villages across the Ottoman Empire, and an inspiration to many. As more Armenians make pilgrimages to their ancestral towns, now in Turkey, the memory book leaves the shelf or the bedside and makes the journey back home with them. Meanwhile, from New York to London to Beirut, Armenian youth are embracing the culture and rituals of their ancestral villages and towns, places last inhabited by their great-grandparents. In 2023, I received an email from an Armenian-American couple. "We are getting married this summer," they wrote, "and we'd like our ceremony to reflect the traditions of the towns our ancestors hail from, Gesaria and Dikranagert. Can you assist us with resources?" I identified relevant pages from memory books dedicated to the two cities and sent them the scans. My heart was full. In many ways, our ancestors' journey of return and reclamation is very much alive. In the immediate aftermath of the 44-day war in Artsakh in 2020, tens of thousands of Armenians were forced to leave their homes behind in territory ceded to Azerbaijan. One family decided to take their home with them. The image of the small house mounted on a truck on a highway out of Nagorno-Karabakh embodies the experiences that gave birth to the memory book. For countless refugees and migrants across the globe, carrying their home with them is not an option. But they do carry much that is intangible. They cling to it, cherish it, and claim it. They strive in their own way to recreate home away from home. This talk is dedicated to them. Thank you.
You spoke about heart, and these books seem to me to have a lot of heart. They are not cold academic works, not that academic works are necessarily cold, but they're overflowing with personality and life and, you know, happiness and sadness. They seem to possess a lot of what we would call heart. And in our collection here at Nasser, it's the one area in the library where, because space is at a premium in any library, we can't keep endless duplicate copies of most books. But in the Hushamadyan room, there are many copies of some of the books because they seem to represent the lives and the hearts of the people who own them. So I would just want to ask you to talk about the sort of style of these books. They're kind of hybrid works and have a certain personality.
I think personality is the word for it, right? In many ways, each one of these works is absolutely unique. And you can see it, and the uniqueness, what is personality? It is the imperfections that makes one who they are, right? And in many ways, these works are imperfect in different ways. And these imperfections sort of are what makes this one reason why exploring these works and studying them and reflecting on them makes them so meaningful. The other way in which the personalities come through is just like any personality, it is also a reaction to other personalities. And this too comes across in many of these memory books, right? As I mentioned, there are several memory books dedicated to the same village, right? That's because someone didn't like the way the other person wrote about it. So and you see that, right? You have this really effort that, you know, to sort of recreate something in a time when, you know, with technological advancements nowadays, there are different ways in which one can sort of create a model of something that is endangered or even in the ruins.
You're listening to Khachig Muradyan on Hushamadyan, Armenian Memory Books. This is Independent Alternative Radio. For copies of this program, call us 1-800-444-1977 or online our website, alternativeradio.org.
Back then, these books were the only way to do it, right? Cramming as much information and as much heart and personality that you can almost feel like, if I read this whole thing, I'll be transported back into that land. That is the intention. And this means that there is heart, there is personality, but ultimately the effort is not about saying, me, and look at all the things I know. It is about, this is the biography of this city, and let me do everything possible to make it come alive, come to life. And I do think that the works that do succeed are the ones that are, you know, accomplish that. And that is one way to perhaps evaluate memory books beyond their scholarly merit, and they certainly do have tremendous, untapped scholarly merits.
Question from online from Greg Oftendilian. Thank you, Greg. Many Armenian letters in the pre-genocide period note the oppressive taxation imposed on Armenian villagers by Ottoman authorities. Do these memory books speak of this oppression, or do they mostly portray a kind of idyllic life before the genocide?
Thank you. You said Gregory Oftendilian. Dr. Oftendilian gave a talk at the Middle Eastern Studies Association conference recently, I believe it was last year, and he told a story that very much stayed with me. So I think it's his grandfather who always used to lament that the fruits and the vegetables in the old country are wonderful, and everything here in America is just worthless, right? And the expression apparently which he used was, we wouldn't feed this to our animals back in the old country, right? So there is that idyllic, to go back to his question. I just had to tell that story. But there is that idyllic narrative in a lot of places. But certainly, there's also the whole reason why this sort of genre develops is the genocide and the loss of the homeland. And so the depredations that in the decades leading up to the genocide are documented at length. The massacres, the taxation, the double taxation, the economic challenges, the early waves of, you know, an exodus, all of that is documented. One of the things that sort of brings together many of these, you know, I was saying something about how the personality of these works is the differences and the imperfections of the authors. There's perhaps a few things that really sort of are very similar in many of these works. And it is the way in which they describe the destruction and the loss. It's this world that is very diverse, beautiful, and then it comes crashing down and is sort of this destruction has some kind of equalizing effect, right? Everything is in ruin. Everything is lost. And there, that is where a lot of these memory books actually meet, in that point of destruction. But that's not where these stories end, right? These stories end with revival, and revival manifests itself in different ways. Rebuilding communities in the diaspora, taking pride in every single person who graduates from prominent universities, every doctor, every lawyer, and you name it, right? And so this effort to rebuild is also manifested in that regard. Or creating towns with the same name in Soviet Armenia, or neighborhoods in different parts of the diaspora. All of this is sort of, again, saying that, you know, you couldn't destroy us. You could not, you know, take us out. And that is also, I think, critical. So there is that, on the one hand, that you feel the oppressive environment, you also feel the effort to create an idyllic world. There's this point when everything comes crashing down and everything is sort of becomes the same, right? Ruin and destruction, and then the ways in which the communities are rebuilt.
Is there any effort, either in Armenia or outside of Armenia, to capture these village histories? And I have a number of encyclopedias. If the village is in the encyclopedia, it gives population statistics and the weather and the altitude, but not a village history per se. So is anything being done about this, either in Armenia or outside?
There is some scholarship that I have seen on the subject, but I do not, unless there's certain projects going on right now that I'm unaware of, I do not think there's anything that is really trying to sustain these histories, right? Perhaps I can say that, you know, in many ways, we appreciate things after they are gone. You know, I mean, this whole genre of literature is largely a product of something that was lost. And without that loss, right, it's difficult to imagine it existing, even in terms of trying to document everything, right, and learn and appreciate. So in many ways, and that's true about our appreciation. I've often, in a little bit of a self-critical approach, right, I've often felt that, you know, as I travel to these, you know, Western towns and villages in Western Armenia today, in part of Turkey, and the kind of feeling I get from these ruined churches, right, and the intensity of the emotion, right, when I talk to the locals there, right, is overwhelming. And I think about this sometimes. I think about the fact that when I go to church and I talk to the congregation or the priest, I take it for granted. And we do, and we have lost tremendous amounts of, you know, important, you know, historical information, precisely because of this taking for granted, I think. This is not to say that memory books themselves are being preserved and maintained by the families. A lot of these books, you know, some of the descendants can't even read the language, and they just get rid of them. You know, particularly the manuscripts; those are the ones that are critical, right? And so that is another issue. So we do have that.
What should they do with them, Khacik?
Well, you know, bring them to Nasser. Here's the thing, right? I do think it is important first to appreciate and understand the value and meaning of these artifacts and roadmaps for the people who created them. And anyone here who follows what's going on in Palestine, who follows what's going on in Ukraine, follows what's going on in any other part of the world, in Syria, right, where people lose everything, entire neighborhoods are razed to the ground, right? And there's this effort to preserve and maintain and rebuild, right? This is what, with through photographs and all that technology offers today. These books were all our ancestors had to accomplish that. And as I said, this is just a fraction of what they have produced. Now, it doesn't mean that, you know, all of these manuscripts should be printed, because, you know, that's a tremendous expense and there isn't enough, you know, interest in actually, you know, every single volume. But for purposes of research, for purposes of learning about our history, about the past, about the present, right? And for global history. You would be amazed. One of my current projects actually looks at these works in comparative perspective, particularly the ones dedicated to the Holocaust and the Palestinian Nakba. And you would be amazed at the similarities. You know, there are these village histories with memory maps and by Palestinians who just lost their village. Their village was destroyed and they could never go back. Same kind of angst, same kind of experiences. And there is a great world history of memory books that awaits to be written one day. There has been recently the Diaspora, the Journal of Transnational Studies, published a special issue with three or four case studies. But this is a massive, massive and sort of opportunity to explore what home means to us human beings and the kind of transformative power of that feeling and longing for home in people's lives.
This is from Dr. Nick Hakulian. For books not yet translated like Alboyajian's, are there efforts, means to have them translated? This is a popular question when this topic comes up.
Yes, so I am happy to say that some such initiatives are currently underway. George Arjayan has initiated a project to translate all the books on Palu, and that is in progress already. There are efforts, there are publications of memorial books in different contexts as well. It's difficult to imagine the translation of 2,500-page books. Mm. Hushamadyan does an invaluable favor to the community, service to the community, by providing summaries or focusing on specific towns and villages, or specific like arts and crafts, and, you know, religious traditions, customs, etc. But there's a lot more out there. And I think ultimately in the age of AI, and perhaps this is important for this question, there will be a time when we will be able to have all these memorial books in digital format in a database. It will be easy to translate them from one language to the other through artificial intelligence, and they will be easily searchable. So I'm not one who would advocate for let's, you know, translate everything and print them and publish them, because I realize that it's not something that's going to suddenly be on the New York Times bestsellers list when it comes out. But on the other hand, I do think that technology is giving us new tools of visiting home and recreating home in different ways.
From Dr. Robert Myrack, pointing out that I think he's correct that at least 20 or more years ago, Professor James Russell was one of the first to really call attention to the academic research value of these books. Why do you think it took so long for them to become the subject of academic interest and activity?
I do think that for important constituencies, it was discovered later. For example, for scholars of Ottoman history, few scholars who worked on, you know, Ottoman history knew Armenian to begin with, right? That has changed in recent years, so that's one. So there is increased interest in materials that are not in Ottoman Turkish, and this was certainly part of it. There have been, and it's important to note, I did not mention, several of these books have been translated to Turkish in the past two decades. That's another important phenomenon. In our reality, I think much of the scholarship has focused on the genocide, and much of what has been sort of explored in that scholarship has had a certain kind of focus on what can be, from the perspective of a lawyer, right? The pioneers of genocide scholarship have worked to document the destruction of the Armenian genocide through a particular perspective that wanted to prove it, wanted to give a sense of the scope of the loss. So in that regard, these materials have been used. But beyond that, they haven't. I think that, and this is very telling, because we also see this in oral histories, by the way. In oral histories, I'm often frustrated with oral history recordings where you have valuable information about the history, you know, about the history or customs of a town in the Ottoman Empire, in Armenian town that is being discussed. The survivor is talking about it. And the interviewer will say something like, tell us about the massacres, tell us about the massacres, right? And I'm thinking, just let the woman talk. So you have this kind of approach that for a long time created two worlds. One was our world, where we wanted to keep and recreate, etc., and the other was the world outside. And for that, you were, you know, the prosecutor, and things that did not really serve that purpose received less attention.
Dr. Alan Odeon points out that a variant of the memory book was the series of volumes at published by Richard Hovhannissian based on the UCLA conferences, which I think is entirely right. Yeah.
Yes. The difference, of course, is that those are scholarly works. Yeah. The driving force for a lot of these memory books is this kind of, you know, let's collect as much as possible for the Richard Hovhannissians of the future. Mm. And they will say this. They will say, I'm not a historian, but my effort is to save and preserve as much as possible for the future historian. And so the series that was, you know, a Richard series, let's call it, right, is a product of this. But I would say it's a different kind of historical document.
And the last question, which I think brings together everything that we've covered tonight, from Nazali Dolgarmadjian. I came by Shushan Tigar through her piece Armenian Women Lost in Obscurity, published in the Journal of Armenian Studies in 2002, which was one of the first pieces I read that pointed out that as heroic and treasured as our materials on Armenian history are, there are still narratives that miss important people in our history, namely women, who played crucial roles in Armenia's identity as a Christian nation. With that in mind, what would you say these village histories do not capture or cannot capture? What do they prioritize, and whose voices do they amplify?
Let me give you a few examples. So one of the projects that I've been working on is based on the diaries and accounts and ledgers of two midwives who served as midwives in Aintab, beginning in 1888. They're two sisters, Armenian, and then all the way into the, you know, 1940s. They document some 8,000 births that they officiated, babies that they delivered. Initially in Aintab and then in Aleppo after they are forced out of Aintab. In memory books dedicated to Aintab, these two sisters are not mentioned. They have family members who've become doctors, real doctors, quote unquote, and you see pages and pages about them. So in many ways, in this revival period, right, there's a sense of being proud in our doctors who are going to Yale and getting degrees. But these two sisters, just one example, who single-handedly, I have a photograph that a friend has shared with me of an extended family, three generations. Almost every single person in that picture was delivered by one of these two women. But they don't exist. I have to look for a line here, a reference there, etc., and interviews to add to the massive material that they have in order to be able to tell their story. This is tremendous erasure without even realizing the value of this, right? Now we do, but how do you go back and reconstruct that when the memory book itself has not deemed it important enough, right? You don't read anything about the midwives, about the nurses of the period at all. Mostly women, right, in these memory books. And of course, as I mentioned earlier, overwhelmingly, with very rare exceptions, these are books published by written and published by men.
So let me just make a pitch then. If you do have these books in your home and you don't know what to do with them, or manuscript materials relating to these books and you don't know what to do with them, we're not trying to take your treasures from you. But if you don't know what to do with them, there are responsible organizations such as Nasser and other libraries and archives and institutions that will cherish these materials and do cherish them. So please let such materials never be simply lost.
And may I add something to this,
please,
Mark? I think that even if you want to hang on to these documents, right, I think it wouldn't be a bad idea to give a library a digital copy.
Agreed.
Because someone down the line in the family will not want to hang on to it, or something is going to happen to it, right? So if you have it now, you don't have to give it to me or to Mark. Make sure there's a copy of it, digital copy of it available, and it's, that can be accessible to researchers to do work on these materials.
Indeed. And now please, please applaud for Khatchig Mouradian.
You were just listening to Khatchig Mouradian on Hosham and Yan, Armenian Memory Books. He spoke in Belmont, Massachusetts in mid-November 2024. Khatchig Mouradian is the Armenian and Georgian Area Specialist at the Library of Congress and a lecturer in Middle Eastern, South Asian, and African Studies at Columbia University. He's the author of The Resistance Network and the editor of the Armenian Review. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, an independent nonprofit in our 39th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature such voices as Gabor Mate, Bedros Dermatosyan, Tariq Ali, Norman Finkelstein, Ilan Pape, Peter Beinert, and Francesca Albanese. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. For copies of today's program, Khatchig Mouradian on Hosham and Yan, Armenian Memory Books, and for Peter Balakian's classic history, The Burning Tigris, The Armenian Genocide, call us 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or online on our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. Printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program are free of charge. Just call us, 1-800-444-1977. Special thanks to Mark Mamigonyan and Sam Fuqua. Joe Rich is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamyan. Thank you for listening. We go out with Oneg Dingchian singing in Armenian, Shek Mazerove.
Yarmuneik shatpari, zanotatsa antsial dadi. Yarmuneik shatpari, zanotatsa antsial dadi. Anak arin serkes dadin. Shut up, Lobe. Gather, Murdoo.
Listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, also heard at translator K220HR Hood River at 91.9 FM, and translator K282BH in